But we are on the doctrine of Scripture today, and by way of review, we've been looking at the subject of the New Testament canon, and we have given three proposals as we consider copies of the original manuscripts. We're thinking about how to think through copies of the original manuscripts. And just reviewing those three proposals, we said a couple of weeks ago, we have proposal number one, we have an abundance of manuscripts for us to study, and in that abundance, the original text is preserved. Remember, we said there were over 6,000 parts or whole parts of early Christian copies of the New Testament documents, and that's not including all of the many, many, many more thousands of translations, early translations into other languages. Proposal number two, we said that the vast number of changes are minor and insignificant. And we talked about, you know, spelling changes, word order, things of that nature. In fact, last week somebody pointed out that in my notes, I can't remember what text it was, I should have looked at this ahead of time, I think I put in the notes, it says Matthew, I don't have my old notes from last week, but I think it's like, what was it? Is it Luke?
Yeah, it was Luke 2:23, and it should be Luke 2:33.
All right, there we go, yes. So in my notes, I reference Luke 2:23, and it should have been Luke 2:33. And several people pointed out that this is exactly what we're talking about here in terms of changes that happen. Anybody who looked up Luke 2:23 would realize he's got the wrong verse, and if they let their eyes scan down a little further, they would see the correct verse in verse 33. And so that kind of a change, it was a mistake, but it is not significant to really change anything of the meaning of what's going on. It's pretty clear what happened.
Did you do this on purpose to illustrate the point?
No. My greatest weakness in writing is grammar mistakes and occasionally, you know, stuff like that. So
I opened the door for you.
Yeah, no, I would like to say it was on purpose, but
it was providence.
It was not. Yeah, it was providence. Thank you. So, vast number of changes are minor and insignificant. You can pretty clearly see what happened. Proposal number three, we talked about through careful textual criticism of the few variants that are significant, we can determine with reasonable certainty which is the original text. And we looked at some examples of those. So we're thinking about copies of the original manuscripts. How do we think about the fact that not all of them match up exactly? Right. Here's one more proposal that I want to talk about today. And this will be fairly short, and then we'll get into the issue of translations. Proposal number four, the remaining unresolved variants are very few and do not change the essential teachings and accounts of the New Testament. Remaining unresolved variants are very few and do not change the essential teachings and accounts of the New Testament. So, let's give an example. Mark 3:32. Hopefully that's the right verse. All right. Here's a question for you as you think about it. Is it your mother and your brothers are outside? Your mother and your brothers and your sisters, excuse me, I read my own notes right. Start again. Is it your mother and your brothers are outside seeking you, or is it your mother and your brothers and your sisters are outside seeking you? Okay, there are real scholars in the text that would say, there's a lot of really good texts that add the phrase sisters, and there's a lot of really good ancient texts that don't have sisters. This is one where scholars are not sure, because there's substantial conflicting evidence. However, does it change anything about the passage or our understanding of the New Testament? Not really. It does nothing really to change the passage, as we do know elsewhere in the New Testament that Jesus had sisters. So, in other words, even the story of Jesus isn't changed by this question. Is it an important question? Yeah, I want to make sure that we get every word as much as possible accurately to the original author. But nothing of substance is really changed in terms of the actual teachings and accounts in the New Testament. Here's another one for you, Luke 22, 43 and 44. Is it, and there appeared to him an angel from heaven strengthening him, this is Jesus while he's in the garden, and being in agony he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground, or are those verses not original? You may not know this, but this is actually one of those texts that is actually heavily debated as to whether it is or is not original. A number of manuscripts have those verses in, a number of very reliable ones do not. Some early church fathers quote this, and some do not when they reference Luke's gospel. But again, nothing of the ministry of Jesus changes one way or another. We do know that angels ministered to Jesus at other times in his ministry. We also know from the other gospel accounts that Jesus was in great agony. The only thing that would be taken away is the picture of the extent of the agony of Jesus. So in other words, we still have a theology in the New Testament of a number of places where Jesus is ministered to by angels. Now, in my own thinking, I actually think these verses are original, but there's good debates on all sides.
I think it would be impossible to actually convey the agony of Christ at this particular time in his life, and I don't think there's strong enough language. So while, yes, it may not be accurate, it would still fall short.
Yeah, I mean, so it's hard to tell, and maybe that was put in by someone teaching on this text, and that people thought it was in the translation because to try to picture it. But I do actually think this is probably original. But the point I'm trying to make is, in this fourth proposal, is even though this variant, this question, is unresolved, it doesn't actually change the essential teachings and the accounts of the New Testament. And again, as I said last week, what I've done for you in these two texts here and also the ones we looked at last week, like the longer portion of Mark, that statement in 1 John, as well as we looked in John chapter 7, I'm giving you, I'm just being honest with you, those are the most substantial things. When you get past these few texts, really, there is very, very, very little question on anything. So, in other words, I'm painting for you the worst case scenario, and of it, we're very clear on a number of these texts. In fact, we'll get to that one in 1 John hopefully a little bit today. So, these are our four proposals when we think about the variants, the changes in that we see between manuscripts over time. Questions about this discussion. We're going to get into English translations here shortly.
I heard a comment one time, well, what about Judas Iscariot and his death? How it's explained two different ways, one that he hung himself, one that he fell and dashed to pieces. And that was one that they were like, well, you can't trust the Bible, they can't even get that right. I thought, well, that was an interesting concept. He died, so overall, he died. But that was one thing that was presented.
Yeah. Technically, that is that's an important question. Technically, that would fall under a different heading, in that there's no concern about the authenticity of the original manuscripts. It's more how to reconcile two different accounts. And that's a very, very important question, one that I'm not going to try to explain all the details now on. So,
talked to Josh Rockensock. He had studied that, and it was very interesting.
All right. So if you didn't hear that.
Not here.
Yeah, Josh Rockensock is not here, but Scott said that he studied that issue out. Did he have to do it for a paper or something?
I don't know, but it was fascinating.
Yeah. He studied it in science.
Okay. All right, let's talk a little bit about translations. Oh, did I miss a blank for you guys?
Yeah.
Letter C, these kind of unresolved variants are rare. and not one alters what we believe as Christians as to the essentials of the Christian faith. All right, let's talk now about translations. And as we start, we're going to spend a little bit of today and then next week talking about the King James only view. King James only view. Now, just as I start, just I want to give some kind of broad comments here. Pastor Greg and I were talking here this morning and then praying, and I'm thankful, and we are thankful, that largely this has not been an issue within our congregation for a long, long time. In fact, I don't know if it has ever been an issue in the history of Sunrise Bible Church. There have been people who have been members who have had a stronger affinity for the King James. But I know George Cable was not King James only. I know Jim Rockensock was not King James only. And I'm pretty sure Canada back in the day would not have been King James only. And quite frankly, before we get before Jim Rockensock, there aren't hardly any of you left around here that would have known the difference, probably. So, I mean, now we're talking, you know, that's 40, over 40 years right there. So I'm thankful. However, this is an issue that crops up, and it does affect people, and people get trapped up in it. And we have had people who have tried to come in over the years and make this an issue. I'll give you the most extreme case. Some of you may remember this a number of years ago. It was on a Sunday night, is that we had a gentleman who came in, and he showed up at the service, and I don't even remember anymore what I was teaching upon. But when we got done, he came up to me in the presence of several of you who were around when this conversation happened and straight up looked at me and said that I was a heretic and this church was full of heretics and denounced us. And one of the reasons was because of the issue of the King James, that I didn't use the King James. And I mean, he put it in no uncertain terms. I mean, it was like hellish, like you are... You know, you're in big trouble. Right or wrong, I looked at him and I said, "You are a divisive man, and we do not want you in this place. If you're willing to talk about it, we can. But otherwise, I expect you to leave right now and don't come back unless you actually want to have a serious conversation." You didn't come back. Now, that guy was an extremist. It was pretty clear. He came that night with an agenda. He criticized other things that went on. But this is an issue that does crop up, and not in that necessarily in that extreme way. People get confused on this issue, and I am sure that if you've been a Christian for a while, you've run across this issue of King James onlyism. So I want to talk about it a little bit and kind of work our way through it. Now let's talk about just first of all some reasons why people use the King James or only use the King James. Some use the King James because it's what they know, have used for most of their life, and trust. And if that's you, I don't have a problem with you, so just want to say that. I am, when I get to the end of talking about translations, going to say in the long run, I don't think that the King James is the best translation for people to use anymore, especially... given how the substantial changes have happened in the English language. But if you know it and you like it and you use it and you read it and you trust it, it is a reliable translation, and I praise God for that. So if that's you, I'm not picking on you at all. Second, some use the King James because they distrust change. And I have a great deal of sympathy for this. This is not so much of an issue right now, but in the 80s and 90s, there were a lot of churches and into the early 2000s that had substantive changes in their philosophy. You had a lot of the church growth movement, and churches changed what they once wore down their theology over time. And one of the things that people observed is, you know, they would, you know, that you'd have pastors or elders that would lead in all sorts of changes. Worship styles changes. The Bible version changed. Philosophy of ministry changed. And people who looked at that just see that a change in something like a version is representative of other things. And it could be, but it's not necessarily so. I don't really have a beef with people who are just leery of change because of their experiences in bad leadership. So I don't want to pick on that either. Again, I'm going to say in the long run, I don't think the King James is the best translation for today. However, I understand and have a great deal of sympathy for this viewpoint. Here's a far more problematic, in fact, view. Some people use the King James because they believe it as a translation was re-inspired by God. And I'll just say this very clearly. This is a heresy. And we should not have Christian fellowship with people who hold this view. Now, and I mean that I should say, as I have it in my notes, we should not as a church have Christian fellowship with people who hold this view. Okay. And so now this is a very extreme view. There are some that hold this. The most famous of individuals was a fellow by the name of Peter Ruckman. He's now dead. He taught at the Pensacola Bible Institute. That is not the same as Pensacola Christian College. I just want to make that very, very clear. Those are not the same things at all. Okay. But he taught at the Pensacola Bible Institute. He believed that the King James was the final preserved word of God for the English-speaking peoples and that there was no possibility of a version that would come, or a translation, excuse me, that would come after that. He is quoted in one of his newsletter. It was called the Bible Believer's Bulletin. This is in January of 2008. So he started teaching, I think, in the 70s, maybe in the early 80s, something like that. I should have looked that up for sure. But he had several books that were influential and also had a newsletter called the Bible Believer's Bulletin. And as late as 2008, he says this, What blank freshman fool didn't know that there are more than 150 quotations from the Hebrew Old Testament that pop up as a translation in the Greek New Testament in every copy of the New Testament ever printed? The first time they were inspired in the Hebrew language, and the next time in the Greek, they were double inspired. They were not inspired in a different language, and many times the translations did not match the original Hebrew or the original Old Testament manuscript or the Hebrew text. And what he went on to say is that because some of the New Testament authors use the Greek Septuagint in their writings in the New Testament, which sometimes differs from what we have in the Hebrew Old Testament, that this is evidence that God could, over time, re-inspire new translations that were not the original. And thus, he argued, the King James was actually a new, re-inspired translation of God's Word. And it didn't matter that if it disagreed or differed with the original manuscripts. Okay, you following that argument there? So, in essence, what he would literally say is that your English King James is more authoritative than the original language because it is now re-inspired. That was his argument. And that's a heresy. That's a denial of inspiration. Remember, we said the inspiration is the process in which God breathed out Scripture in the original manuscripts. So that's an essential denial of Christian truth. So that is a serious heresy, and thankfully that's very, very small, but you may run across it and don't have anything to do with that.
But that's like when you're in health, and I would give churches in Florida that I showed you one, I was just shocked because it sounded like a really good church until it got to the end where it said that King James was the only English inspired. Wow, it just, you know, you just don't always run across it, but it was right in there, you know.
Yep, it's a problem. So don't go to churches like that. Letter D. Some use the King James because they believe it is a superior translation than others. Now, I don't think that's true, although this is not necessarily a reason why Christians should divide. It may depend on how one's attitude and tone show up on this issue. So, Casey and I came from a church in Wanakee, Wisconsin. Well, before we came here, served at that church as a member and in various capacities for 5 years. The pastor there held basically this view. He viewed it as a superior translation than others. In that sense, he was King James only. But he never really made that an issue. He didn't cause a division in the church. He knew I disagreed with him. We got along smashingly well. You know, I never would use anything other than King James to honor him as the pastor. But that was his position. But he just never made that an issue publicly. And people in his church used different versions. And, you know, if you asked him about it, he would say, I don't think that's the best, but whatever. So that was him. Okay, so depending on one's tone on that, that may or may not be an issue. Finally, some use the King James, and this is probably the majority of reasons of Christian leaders that we'll give for this, using the King James, because they believe that it's translated from the best manuscripts, known as the Textus Receptus, and we'll talk about that in a moment. And while this is an error, it is not one that necessarily needs to divide Christians. Now, I do want to spend a little bit of time on this. The problem with this view isn't just what they believe about original manuscripts. The problem is that I'm not convinced that many of them who hold this view actually would change from using the King James. That there are other things, some of the other factors above that get combined into this. But this is one that you will hear. You will hear people talking about. If you have something like an ESV or a New American Standard, an NIV, and so on, well, the manuscripts that were used to translate those Bibles are not as reliable as the ones that were used to translate the King James. So therefore, you should not use those versions, those translations, excuse me, of the Bible. Now, when we talk about the Textus Receptus, you will often hear people talk about that as the TR, refer to it as the TR. So if you see that abbreviation, that's what it's referring to. TR refers to a small number of Greek manuscripts that form the basis of the New Testament translation in the King James and the New King James. So if you have a New King James, that is based upon the TR. The primary difference between the New King James and the King James is the New King James has extensive footnotes in the bottom of it, or sometimes in the margin, that explains where textual differences occur. There is also one other translation that has been based off the TR that's still used a little bit today. I think it's called, is it like the KJV 2016 or something like that? There was an update that was done. It never has taken hold, but it does exist. I don't remember who published that. Also based off of the TR. And so people will claim that the best manuscripts, original Greek, this is referring to the New Testament only, the best manuscripts in the original Greek for the New Testament are in the Textus Receptus, the TR, and that only Bible versions that use those things are of superior worth. Okay, that's the argument. You will more frequently encounter this if you run into people who are King James only. So I just want to think about that with you for a few moments and give you the history of the TR. I hope that you never run across this, but if you do, you should know this. Because if you do run across this, people who push this will push this hard, very, very, very hard. Okay? So I just want to talk about that. Yes?
So what do they, when they say original manuscripts, what do they mean by original manuscripts?
They mean,
if we have the original letters, we only have copies, so they can't say.
Yeah, they would be talking about copies of the original. So they would be talking in the family of texts that have been copied, those manuscripts is what. So you're correct in that distinction. Yeah, nobody believes that we have the actual originals written by Paul or Peter or Luke and so on.
So what the scholars have been able to do over the years is to compare manuscripts and look at the older manuscripts that have fewer...
You should come back from the South more often because we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. So, no, you are absolutely right, Gary, and I don't want to cut you off except for we did actually cover that. So, yeah.
I should have been here before.
So let's talk about in thinking about the original manuscripts issue. Originally, as we have noted, the New Testament was written in Greek. Over time, the church divided between the East in Constantinople and the West in Rome. As the church divided between the East and West, the language of the West was dominated by Latin. The East retained Greek. The textual families over time split. By textual families, I'm referring to copies of those Greek manuscripts coming from the originals at some point. The Eastern Church used a text family that is often called the Byzantine text that comes from the Byzantine Empire, which was centered in Constantinople. That's modern-day Istanbul in Turkey. In the West, and I'll talk about what this means here in a second, in the West, three distinct textual families came about. The Caesarea text, that's in Israel, the Alexandrian text in Egypt, and the Western text, which is scattered about the greater Roman Empire, which was kind of a mix of the two and some independent readings. Now, here's what we mean by textual families. It's easy for us to forget today because with the power of the internet, not even just before the internet, I mean, even just rewind 100 years ago, how easy it was relatively, even 100 years ago, compared to human history, to get from point A to point B, to do work of comparison, to exchange things. You have to understand, if we rewind the tape to, let's say, 400 AD, right? If you had a copy of the New Testament in Greek, I mean, that was a great, great privilege. They were largely housed in churches. It's extremely expensive because every one of those had to be hand copied. If you had one, maybe in your city you had a few copies of the entire original New Testament in your city, right? But your ability to go and take those copies and run over 100 miles away to compare it with the copies that they had, that was practically zero. The danger of even just, you know, taking those copies elsewhere and potentially losing them was extremely high. So over time, as you made copies of the copies, any mistakes or spelling changes, that kind of stuff, they developed into textual families, often seen in a region. And that's what we're talking about here when we talk about the Byzantine or the Alexandrian or the Caesarea text, and so on. Okay, so you can see that over time. And as I've said to you, I'm just way smarter people than me have looked at this. Now, even though the Orthodox Church in the East continued to use Greek, there are no known manuscripts of the Byzantine text family before the middle of the 4th century. And this is likely because there were manuscripts brought to Constantinople when Constantine made it his capital. That was eventually when the East and the West split, became the foundation of the Byzantine Empire. So in other words, you remember that Constantine, he moved the capital from Rome to Constantinople. And when he did that, along with him came a bunch of Christians, because Constantine gave Christianity a great deal of leeway. And with that, there would have been Greek manuscripts that would have come with him. And from there, they made lots of copies. In fact, they made many, many more copies, because they actually continued to speak Greek even when Latin took hold in the West. But we don't have one single copy of any of their manuscripts that comes before 350 AD. And that's probably, like I said, because the first copies they had came from the West and then were distributed in the East. Now, of course, the Roman Catholic Church experienced the Protestant Reformation, think Martin Luther, 1517 AD. When the Reformation occurred, Latin was the official language of the Church of Rome, and the Latin Bible was the only Bible that was available largely, we'll talk about some exceptions, to the people of the West, even if they spoke a different language. The scholars of the Church and the Roman Catholic Church used the Latin Bible largely up until the time of the Reformation. If they did use a Greek manuscript, it was from one or two available in their particular location. So roughly for about 800 years, churches and Christians in the West of Europe, they used Latin. And because of that, they stopped making as many copies. They did happen, but they stopped making as many copies of Greek. And they used the same as copies of the Greek manuscripts. And they used that same Latin Bible for centuries, known as the Latin Vulgate. Enter a fellow named Erasmus of Holland. He was a Dutch scholar. He lived from 1469 to 1536. Let's talk about him for a moment. Erasmus was a brilliant scholar in his day. He traveled over much of Europe lecturing and teaching. In fact, he was in the courts of kings and often educated some of their children frequently. People were very interested in him. Erasmus, though he lived right in the beginning stages of the Reformation, never joined the Reformation. He was a heavy critic, both of the Catholic Church and the Reformers. It is really hard to know if he had a serious spiritual interest. Some people believe that Erasmus was just kind of like a modern-day scholar who just, you know, got his kicks off of, you know, learning stuff, teaching stuff, having influence. He wasn't an atheist, but he didn't really land where you would want him to land on important theological issues, both for the Catholics or the Protestants. He just had more fun picking on both sides. But he did never officially leave the Catholic Church, so he was technically a Roman Catholic. Erasmus went to England and taught at Cambridge from 1509 to 1514. You're just looking at you, Harvard, saying, man, your history is pretty pathetic compared to that, right? All right, Cambridge has been around for a long, long time. Incidentally, William Tyndale, if you know that name, studied there and probably learned Greek under Erasmus. It becomes very important in the history of English translations of the Bible. Now, as a professor of Greek, he began to think very seriously about producing a Greek New Testament that could be printed. So he ended his time at Cambridge and took a trip to Basel, Switzerland in 1515, and there a friend convinced him to produce one, that is a Greek New Testament. Now you need to remember that the printing press has only been invented in 1440. It was still relatively new and still very expensive to produce lengthy books. People had made copies of the Latin Bible, but nobody had made a copy of the original Greek, or not, excuse me, nobody had made a copy of the Greek New Testament. So Erasmus was interested in this. So in Basel, what he did is he gathered all the manuscripts he could find in that city, and it came to a grand total of 6. Not one of them contained the whole New Testament, and none of them fully agreed with each other. The one he had of Revelation did not contain the end of Revelation, so he translated from Latin back into Greek to produce a complete Greek New Testament. You following that? So he took the Latin and translated it back into Greek so that he could have a quote-unquote complete Greek New Testament. Also, it's worth noting that none of the manuscripts that he used were earlier than the 10th century, although many people believe they were actually 12th century manuscripts. There's some debate on that. But either way, we're talking somewhere between 950 to 1150 years after the publication of the originals by the apostles and their associates. Now, he published several additional editions, but he did not include additional manuscripts. In other words, he cleaned things up. So he published his in 1516, 672 pages long. You think about how expensive a book that would have been. Pretty pricey back in that day. It had lots of mistakes, so he published additional editions. But he did not include, as I said, additional manuscripts. So his text that he edited together of those six documents, those six manuscripts, it was only from those six that he made his Greek New Testament. Now remember, we said that we have well over 6,000, we're pushing almost to 7,000 manuscripts today that are in existence. Erasmus used six, and they're all from one city. Okay. Now, what should we think about his contribution? While it is not all that we, or at least I, would like, it was incredible for his time. This, in spite of the criticism that I'm going to give about this, this was a huge advancement in the study of the Bible. Really, really important. From it, Luther translated his German Bible from the second edition of Erasmus's text. Ulrich Zwingli, he was a Swiss reformer, very important in the Reformation, learned Greek and the Bible from his text. Tyndale, William Tyndale translated the Bible into English from it. Erasmus's text transformed people's study and use of the Bible. Very, very important. So he wanted this to be available for people to use. And so he used what he could to make it happen. But it was very, very small. Okay. It's also under Erasmus, I don't think I have this in your notes, that the debated verses in 1 John, remember we talked about the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, that text in 1 John 5, those verses appear. There were a number of Catholic scholars when Erasmus published his text were furious because there were places in his Greek text that contradicted the official Latin Vulgate that was sanctioned by the Pope, including those disputed words in 1 John. And Erasmus promised that he would insert those verses if someone could produce a single Greek manuscript that could be found to contain that passage. He should not have said that. It was one of those like rhetorical things, you know. If you can find me one text that has this in. So, at length a copy was found, or as one commentator has written, made to order. As it now appears, the Greek manuscript that he found was written in Oxford about 1520, which was a year after the publication of Erasmus's second edition by a Franciscan friar named Froy, who took the disputed words from Latin and inserted them in Greek into a manuscript, brings it to Erasmus and says, "We got one. Put it in." So under pressure, because remember, this is in a very hot time in the early parts of the Reformation, Erasmus caved. And I would like to be a critic of Erasmus, but if I was in his position, I don't know what I would do. I might have done the same thing, because you might think, well, this is a small matter compared to the bigger matter of getting this Greek New Testament out there. But he caved and he put it in. However, when he published in his fourth edition this text, he put in a lengthy footnote that he had great suspicions about the manuscript And actually, even in Latin, no Latin version has been discovered with those words before 800 AD. So they are almost assuredly not original. Now, it is Erasmus's text that becomes the basis for the TR. And we'll talk about how that comes about next week, God willing, when we get to a few more important characters in the history of this account. I'm over time. We've got to be done.